It's called The Peace Process. Great friend of mine, great friend of America, is one of the greatest columnists in America from the Boston Globe, nationally syndicated, Jeff Jacoby. Good morning, Jeff. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Good to talk to you again.
Thank you. I was just kind of reminiscing with you off air, and I think it's true that I first met you when you wrote a column. I was a starving law school student in Boston in 1994, and I was reading the Boston Globe trying to avoid having to do my civil procedure homework or something, and I was reading a column of yours. It was right after Yasser Arafat won the Nobel Peace Prize,
right.
And no one was writing anything interesting in those days, quite frankly, except you. And you went and spoke to Elie Wiesel about it, a previous Nobel Peace Prize winner, and I thought that was interesting. And you elicited a quote from Elie Wiesel, and he said his reaction to Arafat winning the Nobel Peace Prize was, "I'm in the club with this guy."
That was about the size of it, exactly. Yeah, I was appalled when the Nobel Peace Prize in 1994, that was 1 year after the Oslo Agreement, 1 year after the start of this peace process that we've heard so much about now for, you know, the last 16 or 17 years. They gave the Nobel Prize to Yitzhak Rabin, Shimon Peres, and Yasser Arafat. And the thought of the world's most prominent living terrorist getting the Nobel Peace Prize just was so revolting to me. And I thought, how can I convey the idea of this without it having to be my words?
Right.
And, you know, back in those days, I occasionally would get a brainstorm. And I had one that day, and I called up Elie Wiesel,
yeah,
and asked him what he thought about it. He, of course, you know, the world's most famous survivor and chronicler of the Holocaust and a Nobel Prize winner himself. And, yeah, and he said words to that effect, you know, that he and I are now, he meaning Arafat, and I are now in the same club. It was, you know, it was a remarkable thing. I remember he was saying, at least he should apologize.
At least he should apologize.
At least he should apologize. They're going to give him the award. Let him get up and say, I'm sorry for all the innocent blood that I shed. But, of course, there was never any such apology from Arafat, nor has the Nobel, you know, committee ever retracted that award. You know, it was clear to some of us then, but by now it's clear to everybody that, you know, Yasser Arafat was no peacemaker, and peace didn't come to the Middle East. And the longer this misnamed and misbegotten peace process goes on, the further and further peace recedes.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that. You wrote a fabulous column over the weekend. We have a link to it up at BillBennett.com. It's called Victims on the Road to Peace. Before I get to that, though, I want to spend one more moment on this Arafat business, because what that led to is the idea that his party, Fatah, of the PLO, the largest party of the PLO, now runs the Palestinian Authority. What that has led to is the claim we've been speaking about, what's moderate Islam. These are now considered the moderates, right? Fatah, the PLO, Arafat, Abbas, this is now all considered moderate. That's the word you keep seeing again and again and
right.
Again. They've never changed their flag. It's all the state of Israel. And one more quote from Elie Wiesel, I'll never forget. He didn't say it in your column. He wrote it in a book years before. He said, the definition of confusion is when good and bad are put on the same plane and the evil receive the sanction of the just. And I just think of that over and over again as I see this
Read that quote again. Let's hear that again.
The definition of confusion is when good and bad are put on the same plane and the evil receive the sanction of the just.
Yes, that's very good. Right. When the world, you know that you're living in a confused world when the just, when the good people, when the people who want to be righteous and who want to do the right thing find themselves genuflecting towards something that's truly evil. And boy, do we see a lot of that.
Tell us what happened last week, right as Benjamin Netanyahu and Abu Mazen from the Palestinian Authority were on their way to meet with President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
There was, as you know and as our listeners know, there was a terrorist attack that took place. Actually, there were a couple of terrorist attacks on Highway 60 in Israel. Four people were in a car, a middle-aged couple, parents of six. The wife was 9 months pregnant with their seventh child. Two other residents of the town that they live in called Beit Haggai that they had picked up and were giving a ride to, going south of the hills around Hebron, and the terrorists opened fire. Four people are killed. And not only were they killed, but the terrorists, one or more, I'm not sure that they've nailed down exactly how many there were, then came up close to the car and fired dozens of additional bullets at short range into the bodies to make sure that the victims were, you know, good and dead. So that when the bodies were found, they were riddled with dozens of bullets. And all this as Netanyahu was on his way to Washington for more of this, more peace negotiations and more talks and all the rest of it. Immediately, Hamas, which was responsible for this terrorist attack, puts a statement out on its website, taking credit and praising it and so forth. To me, what was more interesting, and this goes to your point, Seth, about how Abbas and Fatah and the Palestinian Authority are supposed to be moderate, they put out a statement. Fatah puts out a statement. The so-called moderate wing of the Palestinian leadership puts out a statement in which they criticize this terrorist attack, not because it's evil and not because it's brutal and not because the slaughter of innocent people is something that every decent person should be revolted at, but because, and these were their words, it contradicts Palestinian interests. It wasn't that it was wrong to murder four, five, if you count a baby that was a few days away from being born, five innocent victims. That wasn't bad. It's that carrying out a terrorist attack at this moment under these circumstances was against the pragmatic interests of the Palestinians. The idea that there's a fundamental difference between Fatah and Hamas is completely illusory.
It is completely illusory. I don't know if enough people, I spoke a little bit about this last week. It blew me away when it was happening. If enough people remembered the whole dust up between Benjamin Netanyahu and the administration, because some official in the Israeli government had announced that they were going to
going forward with a perfectly routine building
right, a building plan. At the same time, what was not covered was the dedication of a park with a plaque and a memorial to a woman who had killed 37 Israelis and one American, a terrorist, not a Hamas terrorist,
right,
a Fatah terrorist, in the West Bank under the Palestinian Authority,
right,
where a member of the Fatah party spoke and saluted her.
Dalal Mughrabi, who was the mastermind of the so-called Coastal Road Massacre, which
right,
took place years before Hamas even existed.
Right.
A full-fledged member of what was then simply called the PLO,
right,
and Fatah was the largest faction within the PLO, hijacked a bus, murdered 37 people. One of them, as I recall, was an American
yep,
photographer
yep,
who, if I'm not mistaken, was either a niece or a cousin to Abe Ribicoff.
Yes, that's
former
correct.
Senator
that's
from,
correct.
From Connecticut.
That's correct.
And they do this over and over again. Just last week, Abbas was at some kind of a funeral for another, terrorist mastermind who had finally gone to meet his maker. And he was there in the room, and he was reading the words from the Quran and all the rest of it. They named summer camps and street squares and public parks and playgrounds after terrorists. Over and over again, the Palestinian media, which is controlled by Abbas, by the Palestinian Authority, by Fatah, puts out the most vile inciting kinds of rhetoric against Jews, against Israel, urging children to grow up to become terrorists. The idea that Fatah is moderate and an appropriate partner for peacemaking, it really is such a delusion, and yet it's a delusion that the whole world seems to want to buy into.
It's a delusion the world wants to buy into, and the ultimate goal of all this is not some kind of treaty. It's to give up the West Bank. That's what they want. They want the West Bank and maybe Jerusalem as well. But what gives lie to this? This is unbelievable to me. I was reading your column. I stopped and had to reread the third paragraph twice, okay? Israel withdraws from all of Gaza when? 2005?
Correct.
Unilaterally withdraws from Gaza the territories, the occupied territories Israel had to withdraw from to get peace. It got Hamas instead. And then you write over these terrorist attacks that happened last week, a victory rally was held in the Jebalia refugee camp in Gaza. And what? A refugee camp? And why are there refugee camps in a place that they've run for 5 years? Israel is not running Gaza. Why are there still refugee camps in Gaza?
Yeah, every piece of that sentence actually should make a person go, whoa, and raise the eyebrows. First of all, as you say, why are there refugee camps still in Gaza? These refugee camps, by the way, were not run by Israel.
Right.
They've been run all these years by a special United Nations agency set up to treat Palestinians in a way unlike all the world's other refugees over the past decades have been treated. So that even though most of the people living in the so-called refugee camp were born there and their parents were born there, Jebalia refugee camp, so-called, is really just a small city.
Yep.
But it's treated by the United Nations and the whole United Nations apparatus as a refugee camp as part of the ongoing Arab-Palestinian propaganda campaign in which the enemies of Israel are portrayed as refugees. It's so often, it is certainly true that in 1948, when Israel was created, a war took place. The war was declared by the Arabs. And in the course of that war, several hundred thousand Arabs left what became Israel and have been known as refugees. At the very same time, as you know, Seth, hundreds of thousands of Jews were forced out of Arab and Muslim countries all over the Middle East. They, too, were considered refugees, but you never hear about them for the simple reason that those refugees, like every other body of refugees in history, moved on with their lives, were resettled in another home. In this case, most of them went to the new country of Israel. The only refugees from the post-World War II period that you ever continue to hear about, and there were tens of millions of them at the time. You just think of the refugees when India and Pakistan were separated in 1948.
Right.
The only people still talked about as refugees are the Palestinians, and that's been done purely for political propaganda.
And anyone who doesn't believe that, anyone who doesn't think it's a political propaganda game and that it's Israel's fault, they just have to look at that sentence in your third paragraph. There are refugee camps in Gaza which have been run by Palestinians for at least 5 years now.
Exactly. But think of the other piece of this, the victory rally that was held in Gaza to celebrate the murder of these four Israeli Jews. And on my website, which, you know, I certainly invite our listeners to come.
We have a link to it, actually.
Terrific.
Yeah,
so come to jeffjacoby.com, and I've got a picture up here that shows Palestinian children being encouraged to celebrate the news that four Israelis were murdered. And, you know, I mean, here we are around the corner from 9/11. It takes you back to 9/11 in 2001, when the reaction in so much of the Palestinian areas was to celebrate what had taken place in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania.
I want to stop you right there. We're going to a break. Will you stay with us one more second? I want to pick up on that when we come back, because the lead story in the New York Times, one of the lead stories, is about how Muslims who will not denounce these groups are still feeling as if Americans don't think they belong. We'll be right back with Jeff Jacoby here on Bill Bennett's Morning in America. It's Labor Day, but we're laboring. He'll tell us about that, too. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Of Bill Bennett's Morning in America are brought to you in part by mousemail.com.
Love that, Patty Loveless. Just love that, Patty Loveless. Seth Leibson in for Bill Bennett. Labor Day, Monday, September 6, 2010. Pleased to be rejoined by Jeff Jacoby, who chided me a little off here, just a little, because I had made the claim that so many of the great American songs are about trains. He said they're about cars. You say they're about their cars, right? I guess where would the Beach Boys and Jan and Dean be, or Pink Cadillac? I get you're right, Jeff. There is something Americans love about their cars. It's something they're angry about with regard to the Democrats, too, for messing with them, aren't they?
That's right. Think of Little Deuce Coupe.
Yeah,
and Pink Cadillac.
Right.
You can't imagine American culture in the last 100 years without. In fact, it'd be interesting. I wonder what the first popular song written about a car was.
All right. Well, that is a great question.
And you guys have the audience.
We'll get an answer. I promise you we'll get an answer. I'll email it to you. The person who gives us the first correct answer, I stipulate the first correct answer, I'll get him something. I'll get him a signed copy of Bill's latest book or something.
Yeah, the first popular song in American culture about cars.
That would be great.
I don't think it was, Hot Rod Lincoln.
No, it probably wasn't Hot Rod Lincoln. That's a great question. It really is. Who was it who said, do I have this right? We'll be the first, if we ever go into a Great Depression, we'll be the first country that did so in an automobile or something like that. Does that
something
ring
like
a
that?
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned to you a column that I wrote once about cars and why I think, you know, for all the political incorrectness of saying so, why people having their own cars and driving themselves where they want to go is good. And one of the points that I made in that column, I forget where I had first seen it, was a Soviet author in 1975, writing about how he saw with, you know, many other Soviet citizens the movie made from Grapes of Wrath, the John Steinbeck novel, and that the Soviet authorities had showed this movie because, you know, it showed the Jod family and the Dust Bowl and the Depression and Americans really poor. But what the Soviets saw was that even in America, even in the Depression, all of these poor people were riding around in their own trucks.
Yeah.
It was an astonishing image of opulence to them, and had, you know, completely the opposite effect of what Moscow had intended.
What's the analogy today? I guess homeless with cell phones or something.
Well, Right, something like that.
Something
you can be poor in America and still have, color television and your own text messaging.
Speaking of...
You've got to be poor. America's a great country to be poor in.
Well, but speaking of that, actually, you wanted to say a word or two about Labor Day, which is something that... is celebrating something that's made us poorer too, hasn't it?
Well, I had asked you if you were planning anything special about Labor Day. The striking thing about it, this is thought of as the great labor union holiday. What's striking, Seth, as you know, I don't get to hear you guys on the air in Boston anymore. I'm waiting for you to find a station that's going to put the show back on. But I'm sure that at some point you've talked about how labor unions now primarily represent government employees.
Right.
More government workers belong to unions now than private sector workers.
Right.
Something like only 7% of the private sector labor force is unionized.
Yeah, the growth industry is in the government.
Right, and it's nearly 38% of government workers.
Amazing.
And it has just completely transformed the relationship between taxpayers and their government, because when government workers have the power to vote their bosses out of office, it gives them an astonishing amount of muscle and leverage, which is why we now see, the price that we're paying for these incredibly rich, larded, generous pension programs and health benefits, all kinds of benefits that most private sector workers can only dream about. And yet in so many parts of the public sector, it's taken for granted.
I don't know if you saw this story, Jeff. Speaking of the power of labor unions, there is another one. It's in the public sector. It's the education union. And we've been hearing nonstop for the past year about how there are all these cutbacks in education, how we have to pass special stimulus programs for the education community, the unions, because they're all strapped for cash. $578 million. Dollars, or about $140,000 per student, is the 24-acre Robert F. Kennedy Community School Complex in Mid-Wilshire, the most expensive school ever constructed in U.S. history. To put the price in context, this school, this is amazing to me, is more expensive than the Staples Center, which cost $375 million.
Isn't that incredible? Unbelievable. Yeah,
unbelievable.
What was that? Wall Street Journal?
Unbelievable.
That's incredible. That's an excellent monument not only to public sector contracting, but also to the power of public sector unions. This really is a monument. It's like the Taj Mahal for government employees. You can't underestimate. I mean, we're 2 months from an election now. You can't underestimate the political power that these groups are able to have. If you go to sites like... opensecrets.org, the people
the,
who track...
The funding sites, yeah.
Right, they track money that goes into political campaigns. And they have these pages on that website that show the top all-time donors in various categories. And in category after category, you see labor unions, and especially public sector labor unions, government labor unions, as the organizations that have pumped more money into political campaigns than almost any other.
It's amazing. Will you come back and do election stuff with us on another show another day?
Love to, absolutely.
Well, I really want to thank you for joining us. We've been talking to Jeff Jacoby, syndicated columnist out of the Boston Globe. Jeff, really good catching up with you.
Thank you, Seth.
Thanks for all your great work.